Laura Gotensteiner and Cynthia Santos Briones for The Nation. The walls of this church are the only thing standing between Amanda Morales and deportation. Episode one in a special series, Finding Sanctuary. Joining me, the idea of churches providing sanctuary to those in need is nothing new. But with an increase in ICE arrests and deportations under the Trump administration, sanctuary has taken on a new meaning. Currently, there are at least 36 immigrants throughout the U.S. taking refuge inside churches to avoid deportation. One of them is Amanda Morales. Since receiving a deportation order in August, Morales has been living with her three children in a Manhattan church. Joining me, Laura Gotensteiner and filmmaker and photographer Cynthia Santos Briones. The two are following the family's story, and their series in The Nation is called Finding Sanctuary. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So just sort of an outline broadly, how did you start on the project?
Well, I met Amanda Morales in Holyrood Church at the same day that she took sanctuary with her three kids, Dulce, Daniela, and David. And from that day, I started like photographing and documenting their lives. I asked her in the beginning, like, if she wanted to do it, and she said yes. And Laura and myself and Mala, we started like interview her, documented their life inside sanctuary and taking photos and record voice and videos.
Okay, just back up just a second. So how do you all know each other?
Since Laura. 2012?
Yeah, we've known each other since 2012. And I've always been a really big fan of Cynthia's work. She's done a really amazing photo series called Abuelas about undocumented grandmothers. And then she started documenting people who are in sanctuary, looking at their daily lives, not just going in and then hopefully coming out with protection, but what does it mean to live in sanctuary in this moment?
So the idea of churches providing sanctuary has been around for a while. What are the origins of the sanctuary movement, Laura?
So, you know, the sanctuary movement arose in the early 1980s, in the middle of the U.S.-backed wars in Central America. And I think what's really important to understand is that the sanctuary movement first began as people fleeing these wars, particularly from El Salvador, came to the United States and began organizing an anti-war movement here, demanding the U.S. stop backing the death squads and the right-wing governments in Central America. And part of that anti-war movement that they began organizing was about educating the American public about what was really happening in El Salvador, in Honduras, in Guatemala. And so they went all across the country to different churches, as well as labor groups and student groups, educating people about the war and the anti-war movement. And many U.S. churches were extremely moved and wanted to help and support. And they were also inspired, you know, by the Underground Railroad, as well as by the legacy of European churches sheltering Jews during World War II. So they said, what we can do is we can provide shelter for people as they were fleeing these wars and arriving at the U.S. only to find themselves immediately subject to deportation.
Cynthia, one of the things that I'm always so struck by, and particularly about this, is that churches survive. They survive cynicism. Mm-hmm. They survive politics. What is your sense of why churches are always going to be or have always been this place that of sanctuary?
Because it's their objectives, no? Is the way that why the churches were founded, no? Is help people, support these kind of people who need help, need support. And I live in a church, and it's the spirit of the churches will provide help to those who don't have.
Laura, when did the sanctuary movement get revived? Was the Trump administration the major catalyst, or was there some movement before?
So right now we're seeing more people in sanctuary than at any time since the 1980s. And we do have to say in the 1980s, we saw 500,000 people sheltered in churches, hundreds of churches all across the United States, a really incredible movement. But it did get revived before the Trump administration. It got revived towards the end of the George W. Bush administration, when you started to see a ramping up of deportations. And then it continued and grew all throughout the Obama administration when you really saw a historic number of deportations. And now in the Trump administration, as we're seeing a really ruthless surge in the number of detentions across the United States, not just at the U.S.-Mexico border, but all throughout the interior of the United States, we're seeing, again, an unprecedented surge of the new sanctuary movement, as it's known.
Cynthia, let's talk about what this all looks like for Amanda. What has Amanda's life, what was it like before she took sanctuary?
Well, I don't want to speak a lot about Long Island because I don't want to put her family in risk at some point, but was like every, you know, immigrant family, you know, working with the three kids in the home, making tortillas, like a traditional Guatemalan family life. And she's missing her life back in Long Island, you know, and she's she hopes to come back soon to their real life with her three kids.
And so she was in, what was she doing for work?
She was working in a factory.
And all three of her kids?
Born in Long Island City. Okay. Yeah, are American citizen.
Okay, and so they are all in the church now.
Yeah, they moved to Holyrood Church, and now they are in a school close by to the church.
Laura, what has the federal government said about churches? Are they protected? Are they protected?
Yeah, that's a question a lot of people are asking right now. So according to a 2011 memo, which was issued under the Obama administration, churches are sensitive locations, which means ICE is Immigration Customs Enforcement agents are not supposed to carry out arrests, detentions at churches, as well as at other sensitive locations like schools, hospitals. Unless they say sort of under what they would deem as extraordinary or, you know, circumstances. What does this mean? They can carry out deportations at churches, or they can carry out arrests at churches. We've seen them carrying out more arrests at places like schools. But I think the most important thing is, you know, the sanctuary movement didn't arise because churches are protected spaces legally. It arose because churches are protected spaces morally, where there's a higher law above ICE's policies.
And is there anywhere else where that is the case?
Legally,
but I mean this notion of a space that's protected because it's morally correct.
I think,
or safe, right?
I mean, Cynthia, I think I'd say the churches, as you mentioned, are in their mission are moral spaces where, you know, one government's laws are transcended by what people consider to be humane and just laws. And that's why the sanctuary movement, I think, has so much moral right and weight.
Yeah, even though, like, for ICE, people who took sanctuary or are taking sanctuary, I consider, like, fugitives and criminal, and they can be arrested anytime, you know? Even though it's a moral issue, no? Then
yeah.
Don't do it.
Right. Well, that's I mean, what I'm trying to get at and understand. So in the space of the church, Amanda and her children are protected because it's morally the right thing to do. But if they leave the church, what happens to morals?
Well, I mean, I think that gets to a question about what do we want to see in this country? You know, this is not something that is come out of the blue or started under the Trump administration, but we are seeing, I think because of the extreme anti-immigrant and racist rhetoric of the Trump administration, we're seeing more and more people asking, okay, what is the United States? And what and how in this moment do we want to conduct ourselves in relation to people who come here because they want a life that's safe for their family, which is certainly the situation for Amanda.
Does it feel, Cynthia, like she will be safe? Does she feel safe?
Yeah, she feels safe there. It's difficult, no? Because it's like a house arrest, you know, being in sanctuary is like being in jail, but you are not in jail. She feels safe because she has not, besides the movement, sanctuary movement, and the ecclesiastic people who are support her, it's a community who builds this support, and it's really important, no? I spoke with her yesterday, and she was telling me, Cynthia, I am so grateful that I have a lot of people who come today, yesterday, tomorrow, who are coming, you know, every day and support her, bring her food, money, gift for their children. And it's really good because right now we are looking and seeing like a humanitarian approach of this crisis.
So walk me through like a day for her and her kids. I mean, she's in the church all...
She's all the time in the church, in the spaces of the church, in the room, and it's a library where she is sleeping with her two children. She wake up, she, you know, make breakfast for her and David. Sometimes she took, like, English classes and weaving classes, yoga, Reiki, and sometimes she helps other women around the church to make something, you know, clean or... You know, she participates in the church, mm-hmm. in the activities into the church.
And so how did she find out that she was going to be deported?
It was curious because she was saying the other day that one of her closest friends told her, no, Amanda, you have to fight. You have to figure it out how to find these kind of churches who help people, you know, who are in risk or who have final order or deportation. And basically, they Google in the internet, you know, Santuario in Spanish. And then appears the phone number of Sanctuary Movement Coalition New York. And they call. And they spoke with Father Juan Carlos Ruiz, and was the way that they found, you know, and resolved their case. Juan Carlos knew Padre Luis Barrios for a long time ago, and she presented the weekend before she August 17 in the church, and then she took sanctuary.
And so, what are you photographing?
Why?
What?
What? I am photographing the intimacy moments, you know? I want to have, like, photos that give us, like, emotional approach, psychological impact, the strategies that are building inside the sanctuary, inside the people like Amanda, and... You know, activities that they do during the day, you know. For example, Dulce and Daniela go each Tuesday to musician classes. I went, yeah, they play.
But piano
in the church?
In the church.
It's an after-school program in the church. And sometimes I photograph them when they are, like, singing or playing music or sleeping or taking breakfast or dinner or moments that make us, you know, give us... you know, humanize them,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Laura, how common is it for people to go to their check-ins and get a deportation order?
Yeah, so that's what happened in Amanda's case. She came in 2004 and was detained and held, you know, held for one night and then released. And she didn't know that she had a deportation order at that time. She also didn't know that she could apply for asylum at that time. And in many ways, that points to the faults and the failures of even back in 2004 of how asylum cases were handled, that she wasn't given any information or even given the requisite questioning to ascertain whether she should be put in the process of an asylum case. So she lived for about a decade until she was, like many people, you know, involved in a very minor traffic incident. She was a passenger in a car that got in a car crash. And when the police came, she presented her Guatemalan passport because, you know, and this speaks also to some struggles that immigrant rights groups are waging. You know, there are no licenses in New York State available to undocumented people. So even though she wasn't driving, that triggered what is now known as the ICE check-ins, which under the Obama administration meant once a year, or once every 6 months, you go to the ICE office, you say, I'm here. They ask you perhaps a few questions and you go about your life. That was when there was a system that the Obama administration put into place about prioritizing who was, you know, a supposed priority for deportation and who was not a priority for deportation. So Amanda was not a priority for deportation.
To interrupt you. How is it established who's a priority for deportation? Has it been?
Sure. Under the Obama administration, there was what, you know, the government called an emphasis to deport people who had been involved in crimes. And I think it's really important to note that many of these were still very low-level crimes. And, you know through much of your work, the criminal justice system, you know, disproportionately targets people of color, undocumented people, immigrants. So even many who were subject to, you know, priority for deportation really had been involved in, you know, racial profiling, and at times nothing at all, and at times extremely low-level crimes. That said, there's many people who were deemed not a priority for deportation, people like Amanda, who had been in a car accident that she was not driving. One of the things that the Trump administration did to ramp up deportations as soon as Trump took office was to get rid of any policy for who is a priority and who is not a priority. So now many people who have been going, like Amanda, to check-ins for many years as a very routine part of their lives find that they are now being given final deportation orders. I don't have, and I'm not sure that it exists, the statistics right offhand about how common this is, but it's an extremely common thing that we're hearing about across the country, and it's the reason many people are going into sanctuary. They say, if I go, and Sandra Lopez, who's in sanctuary in Colorado, said this recently in an interview with Democracy Now! She said, I knew if I was going to go to my ICE check-in, I would be put in deportation proceedings. I'd be separated from my children. I'd be forced to pay tens of thousands of dollars to try to get free, and maybe I would never even get free, and I'd be deported. But instead, she said, she took the courageous decision to go into sanctuary because why would she subject herself to that?
I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I'm speaking with journalist Laura Gotensteiner and filmmaker and photographer Cynthia Santos-Briones on their five-part series for The Nation, Finding Sanctuary. Later on in the show, Tayari Jones with her new novel, An American Marriage, and Andrea Hoffman with her book about Patience Ibrahim, a Nigerian woman who was kidnapped by the Boko Haram. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after the break. I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I'm speaking with Laura Gotensteiner and filmmaker and photographer Cynthia Santos-Briones. Cynthia, once Amanda got her deportation order, how did she decide to take sanctuary?
Because their children, because she doesn't want to be separated of their family, of their children, and because come back to her hometown means putting risk her family. Her entire family, her and her children's.
You'd said earlier that she is missing her previous life.
Yeah.
Was that her major hesitation about going into sanctuary, was sort of detaching?
Yes.
And how does she weave that into her life now in sanctuary? The life that she lived prior. I mean, I assume she had to sort of leave pretty much everything, right? I mean, her home, her furniture, her art, her music, her...
Yeah, it's hard. Even though they have been done everything for adjust into her new life in sanctuary, they miss everything, you know? Imagine that one day to the other, you have to leave your home, your school, your family, your community, your freedom.
Yeah.
It's difficult, even though they work every day to be happy into the place that they are right now, and make... a normal life. It is not a normal life for her.
And since you've been so carefully sort of documenting this, I mean, how does it feel for her as an undocumented person to be documented so closely?
It's hard because sometimes I say that the camera could be a gun, no? It's difficult to have a big camera and all the time, like, I want to photograph your intimacy moments, no? But she's trying to understand. For her, it's new, everything, to have to speak in front of the microphone with the media, see her face in the television. But she's trying, and I am trying also to develop the relationship to her feels more comfortable with me inside of her place.
Mm-hmm. And the church is called Holyrood?
Holyrood Church.
Holyrood Church. What is the congregation like?
I think that the congregation are doing amazing work, no? Most of the congregation are like Latinos from Dominican and Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and they embraced her and their children. They have been done as the volunteers also are doing an amazing work, support her case and support her and their children.
And it's mostly Latino?
Mostly Latino. It's like also, for example, the volunteers, that is volunteers for food, for security, for health and legal services. Some of them are like American citizens, Anglo-Americans.
Mm-hmm. Laura, you wrote about the reverend of the church, Luis Barrios. What's been his role?
Yeah, he's really helped revitalize the church as a space for social justice. He's a longtime social justice organizer. And he, but I also want to really echo, you know, Cynthia in emphasizing congregation. As a church and as a neighborhood, it's been really incredible to see the people come together to support Amanda, but also to see how Amanda gives all of these people around her this gift of something they can do and a purpose and a form of resistance that's very daily, that's very intimate, that's very much about personal relationships. So I think one of the things that's so touching to see is, you know, more or less every night on the way back from often long days of work, there'll be a half dozen women, all women, who come by the church and just sit with her and sit around, drink coffee and eat dinner and take care of the kids. Last night we were at the church and one of, you know, one of the closest neighbors, this woman, Isabel, you know, was brushing Dulce's hair and just doing the work of making life together. And that's something that we're really trying to explore in this project, the three of us. What does it mean not just to take sanctuary, what does it mean to make sanctuary? And right. And what, how do we understand that as a gift that we all have? Because, you know, as you asked earlier, outside the church's walls, does that mean the entire rest of the country is not a sanctuary space?
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly what it means in some ways. And I think for Amanda and her children, and what I've been sort of trying to paint a picture of is making that sanctuary and what it reflects and what you want it to reflect and what we as a country want it to reflect. And then, though, how to reconcile with what happens outside of sanctuary. So what do you hope for the evolution of taking sanctuary? What happens? How does it extend beyond the church?
I hope that we can all have to take sanctuary, you know, as the last solution of the last opportunity to stay in the country with your family. You know, I hope that to have better laws to provide us as an immigrants, you know, support.
You're also an anthropologist, is that right?
Yeah.
And how does that mean that has to inform the way that you do the photography work? In what way?
Yeah, the way that I approach most of the time to the subjects that I am working on is like I like to spend time with them. I like to earn the trust, the confidence, and document or use the same, you know, methodology that we use in anthropology or sociology in the photography or photojournalist environment. And yeah, basically like observation and making interviews. And the approach is like more like humanitarian approach, you know? See them as a human, take their own narratives and put them into, you know, the project that I am doing or we are doing.
And how does the idea of, you know, we talked earlier at the beginning about churches and how they somehow are able to continue to be safe spaces or non-judgmental spaces, but there's a lot of religion out there that is quite judgmental. So how does religion play a role in this whole notion of sanctuary?
That's such a great question. I think I'd say that in the sanctuary movement, we have to see it as, at least in the United States, as being informed by the liberation theology that arose in the 1980s and in Central America and in Latin America, and as understanding Catholicism and Christianity, just, you know, to speak about churches, as places that need to be engaged in the struggles of the poor and towards justice rather than sort of on behalf of governments or the military. And I think we have to really remember that, you know, the sanctuary movement is something, it is like ideas and like struggle, something that is trans borders and transnational and is always being, you know, informed by the struggles of others, because we in this country, you know, could see churches as a place of repression, but we can also see them as a place for liberation. And it's also about the identity of religion that's at stake in this struggle. What role do churches play in our country and in other countries? And the new sanctuary movement, you know, which arose on the heels of the original sanctuary movement, is saying we want churches to be the space for justice, and that's how we are going to situate this struggle.
Cynthia, you talk about and both of you have talked about this beautiful sort of warm, embracing community that is literally contained. There's three young children here who are having an interesting life, a very well cared for life. And if the hope is for them to come out of the church, are they prepared for what they'll face when they come out of the church?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
they want to. They want to.
And so in sort of what, do they talk about it? Do they talk about what's outside of the church on a daily basis? I mean, what are the ages of the children?
Dulce is 10 and Daniela's eight and David babies. Just turned 3.
Okay. And so do they talk about, you know, what's going on outside, or we wonder if our friends are playing at the playground, or do they feel sad about that at all? Or
yeah, just Laura is coaching Dulce to write her own story that is going to be published soon in the Nation magazine. And I read some of the writing, and she says sometimes are funny days and sometimes doesn't, no? And it's like she gets fun in her new school that is so Dominican and Puerto Rican. They have like swimming classes and what else? Musician classes and learning different kind of things, cultural. And it's hard for them, you know, because they miss their old friends. They miss their family back in Long Island.
Do they email or talk on the phone?
Yeah, they talk on the phone.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the next installment, Laura, of the series is Dulce's story in her own words. How did that go? How did that work?
Yeah, it was inspired first by Cynthia giving the kids cameras to document their experience, how they see Sanctuary. You know, she's taking professional photos, but, you know, she has been helping the kids also document what their experience has been like. And Amanda also takes lots of photos and videos and documents her experience as well. So we wanted, you know, we wanted to say, you know, we're not like professional documentarians and you guys are just living this experience, you know, so we wanted it to be more of an exchange. But then it also really came from Dulce herself. She said, like, I don't want to do interviews. I'm so sick of doing interviews.
Yeah.
And we said, what do you like to do? And she says, I like to write. So we said, okay. And the family got a computer donated. And the very day that the computer got donated, Dulce sort of like popped it open and just said, you know, typing, once upon a time, there was a girl named Dulce. And from there, she just started writing about her experiences.
And have you been going over drafts with her as her editor?
I did. I will say, Malav and I went to the church last night to visit her. She was on part, she had finished part 6 and she was on part 7, which she had vowed would be her last part. And so I had printed it out. Double spaced, as you know, so we can like have space to mark it up and make comments, you know. And I was like, okay, so you know, here's a pen, do you want to go through it? And she sort of reads it through, and she's very critical. She's constantly like revising it as she reads out loud, but you know, as I gave her a pen and said like the margins are for where you can make the changes, she was like, it's enough. I'm 10. It's enough.
You're doing the most right now, Laura.
Yeah. But it has been really wonderful to hear, you know, how she communicates her experience and how she wants to share it. And that's been like a great blessing for us to get to experience.
And what are some of the observations that she has made in her work?
I'm thinking, you know, a lot of it is about school. Some of it's about how they get to school. For example, she wrote about how at first a volunteer would pick them up and walk them to school and take them to school along with the volunteer's grandchild. And then, you know, they arranged for a school bus to pick them up at school. So she kind of goes through, you know, what is it like to say goodbye to her mom in the church, to not have her mom take her to school, you know, and to then have them go to school together. And, you know, I think it's important, as Cynthia's saying, to remember these are kids and they're living a life that is not normal. They should not be stuck in a church just to avoid being separated from their mom. But at the same time, they're completely preoccupied by daily kid things. So, for example, their new school emphasizes singing, and Dulce doesn't really like singing that much. So she says, I miss my old school because it has a library and because I didn't have to sing as much. So I think they will be really excited to reunite with the rest of their family in freedom on Long Island when hopefully she wins the right to open an asylum case as Amanda's demanding.
Cynthia, one thing I think about a lot for when Laura's saying these are kids, you know, and I think about, do they feel in any way, or is it your sense that they have done something wrong?
No, absolutely not.
Because I hear and read, you know, in this climate of mm-hmm. Undocumented kids being sort of feeling that they're being punished in some way. But it sounds like one of the things that taking sanctuary does is to sort of rewrite or reverse that kind of script.
It's difficult. I think in different situations it's difficult, no? I cannot speak like generalize, you know, the situation, but it's difficult when, for example, sometimes Dulce asks me, why my mom, she cannot go with us and play with outside of the church. And it's difficult when a kid of 10 years old or 8 years old asks you this kind of question, and you are an adult and you have to have the tools or the words to explain them correctly, you know, why? And it, for me, I don't have, sometimes I feel that I don't have the words to do it. And they are like, for example, Dulce is so shy, and we try to interview her and she cried. And she crying, we felt so bad, you know? But when she's writing her own story, she's super excited. And we record her own voice, and she was happy to record like 3, 4, or 7 times, you know? And because the lavalier wasn't working really well. And taking photos, for example, no? And she knows, like, we explain her, you know, this Nation magazine is a really well-known magazine, no? And it's going to be your first publication, you know, as a professional. it's like also to know or hear their own narrative that we need to listen, you know, also. We need to provide to the people to tell their own story.
Another installment of the series will dive into Amanda's life in Guatemala. Just quickly, what is that about?
We're going to look at an upcoming series about, you know, Amanda's legal case and why is it that, you know, she is waiting for months upon months to know if she even has the right to open an asylum case or not. We're going to go through why she came here, what she fears, and what her hopes for her and her family are for the future.
I've been speaking with Laura Gotzendiener and filmmaker and photographer Cynthia Santos Briones on their 5-part series for The Nation, Finding Sanctuary. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.